And welcome back as we keep on going with Proverbs here. This is part three. So we kind of talked the last couple of times about, you know, introductory stuff and then the question of that this whole book is about wisdom. Well, what is wisdom? So now we're going to kind of get into a little more like the meat of the book and kind of, like I said, it's hard to, you know, go like chapter by chapter and find themes and stuff, because like you can read five verses and they'll all five be about totally different things because they're standalone. So we're going to kind of find like themes there and pull in verses from all over, which you can see is like if you look at like the scripture references here, like we've got like chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 7, but then we pop over to 31 and 17 and 15 and 20 and like all over the place. So this week we're going to look at the question of what is love, you know, because that is an idea that pops up a lot in here, things related to love and relationships. So this is going to focus more on like the interpersonal kind of side of that, you know, marriage, family, and the like, rather than like love for humanity, love in society kind of stuff. That'll come up with other things that we look at.
You know what? There's always I love cookies.
There is, especially for some of us, because that is Pastor Kevin's struggle with wise behavior every Christmas season when that's just one of Colleen's family's like big traditions is they bake. I remember the first Christmas we were dating, like she invited me over for like family like cookie baking day. I was like, well, I'm happy to help out. I'm not really much of a baker, despite the last name, but I can, like, do dishes and, you know, help with other, you know, things in the background there. And I figured, like, they'd make, like, a few different recipes. I walk into, like, the Keebler Elf workshop, and it's like, by the end of the day, we'd make, like, a half dozen different types of cookies, and not just, like, a single batch of each. It was, like, double or triple batches. It was, like, hundreds of cookies. It's like, I don't know what I just got myself into here. So Colleen actually has decided, oh yeah, it was amazing. Because my mom was, she liked doing like cake decorating, but she wasn't big on the actual like baking part of it. Like she liked more like the artistry on the other side of it. And she wasn't really a big cookie person. So, like, as long as the Girl Scouts existed, she could get what she needed, and life was fine. But so, yeah, like, going into that, I was like, this is just a whole different world here. And so Colleen, for her part, has, like, decided, like, her role in the family now has been to find kind of all of the recipes that, like, we like that aren't part of the family repertoire. So now there are twice as many types of cookies like floating around our house because we get all the ones they give us and we've got all the ones we make that's left over from, you know, sharing with them and stuff. And it is wonderful and terrible all at the same time. And that's why I take lots of subbing gigs in December if I can get it, because it just gets me out of the house because I don't need to sit around there with like tubs and tubs of cookies.
If you have a nice freezer, you can keep them for summer.
There we go. So we've been known for short-term stuff, like, as long as the weather cooperates. Like, we've got the screened-in porch, so Tims have been known to go live out there to clear room in the kitchen on the counters, because it's like, if it's in the 20s, like, they'll stay nice and fresh out there, and but then the chickens can't get to them if it's in the screened porch, so the worries we have with our stuff. One of our chickens, who fortunately got eaten by a fox, used to like actually like hop up on like the table outdoors and just like help herself to like the kids' sandwiches. Like Henrietta would hop up and just like have lunch with us on the girls' sandwiches. But she was a bully to the other chickens too. I'm glad she got eaten. But anyways, made life better. Anyways, oh wow. Nice. I feel like it's mostly just cookies with us. Like, and like we'll bust out like like my mother-in-law will make like her Swedish tea ring and stuff for like breakfast on Christmas morning and stuff like that. But no, it is cookie palooza. All right, well, talk the love of cookies and other things. The foundation for love in the whole book of Proverbs is actually rooted in something that makes a lot of sense when you think about how much space is devoted to one topic. And that is it is rooted in the idea of faithfulness or fidelity. So love isn't just what you feel. Love is about what you do and how you act out on it. So we've talked a little bit about how the theme of adultery comes up a lot in Proverbs. So I'm going to say, like, considering that it was a book that was largely assumed to be written for a male audience, like, just leave that there, that they need to devote entire chapters to that subject. But, like, the entirety of chapter 5, the entirety of chapter 7, and half of chapter 6 literally just revolves around that one theme there. Which, you know, we're not going to sit and read, like, all, like, 30 verses in each of those, but you can, you know, take a look on your own. But, like, it's very clear that, like, that amount of, you know, space devoted to one topic clearly means it's important to, you know, to Solomon and the other folks who contributed and organized and collated stuff together there for the book. Otherwise, you wouldn't spend that much time on it, right? So one of the challenges that comes up with dealing with, like, the passages about adultery in Proverbs is that it is, you know, very much, like, let's just say, comes from kind of, like, what you'd expect in a very patriarchal and polygamous society, which is what it was, which is that the focus is entirely on warning men away from the wayward woman who is, you know, tempting them into sin. Which I look and there's a little bit of a, like, I mean, okay, I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but I don't think that is 100% of what leads people into, you know, unfaithfulness, like, in marriages and relationships there. But when you consider the source, like, it is unsurprising that that's the framework that gets used. But instead of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, you know, so to speak, they're, like, still within that, like, there is this very clear theme that faithfulness is what love looks like action within, love looks like an action within the context of marriage and family, which is the whole basis for society, right? Like, I remember reading a short novel when I was in college by a woman from Senegal, Mariama Ba. The name is called So Long a Letter, and it's, she was a, like, writing from the perspective of a woman who was recently widowed, writing letters to a younger woman who was, you know, more recently married, kind of reflecting on her married life and kind of, it, you know, her journey as a wife over 3 decades, including her husband, again, it's Senegal, which is a majority Muslim country, like, her husband taking a second wife, because in Islam you were allowed up to 4 as long as you can provide for them, and the ways in which that impacted her relationship. And she wrote in it about how, like ultimately, like, society is comprised of families, and therefore the health of the family is the health of society. Like, a nation full of healthy, functional families leads to a healthy, functioning society. But when there is so much trouble and turmoil at home, it ripples out. That becomes a big theme here, because a lot of what it talks about in these chapters about adultery isn't just the interpersonal, like, fallout of, well, if you go and, you know, cheat on your wife, you're going to have trouble at home. It takes it to, if you go and you are, you know, cheating with another person's wife, there's going to be trouble out in the streets, because you are tearing apart, you know, other people's, like, homes in the process and stuff too. And there's no way for that not to have a like ripple effect of impacting communities and thus impacting the whole of society. Which I think for us is a really good reminder, because like 250 years of independence and rugged individualism as a society, sometimes we forget that we're individuals, but we're also part of communities that are bigger than just like ourselves and like what goes on in our own four walls at home. And it's good to, like, I think, be reminded that, like, yeah, like this stuff that, you know, you think is just your business at home, like, actually isn't just your business at home when it starts involving other people in their homes, and suddenly, you know, you're like behind closed doors, little private affair is actually like something that causes stuff to go on in the wider world around you. Now, that being said, that is not the only way in which love is talked about in Proverbs. Like, it's obviously a, like, you know, neon flashing sign of like, only fools do this, so don't do this. But that's not the extent of how it talks about love and relationship. So family love, outside of just the boundaries of marriage, is similarly like kind of marked by this idea of fidelity and like love being shown in action, not just word. You know, it's good to say I love you, but it's even better to say I love you and then actually show people you love them by acting in a way that shows love and isn't just, you know, empty words and promises, right? Because I think we've all, you know, like I think about, what was it, the Harry Chapin song of Cats in the Cradle? You know, like that kind of thing of like, you can, you know, talk about, you know, how much like, I love you to your kids and stuff, but if you don't make time to actually do stuff with them and show them that, you know, what have you really taught? You know?
You've taught that they're not the important ones, that something else is more important.
Bingo, exactly. And so, like, love looks like ordering your priorities and your actions in such a way that it actually reflects that love that you say you've got. So, again, like, probably the most, let's just say, contentiously debated part of the book of Proverbs is chapter 31, which if folks have got a pew Bible, we'll just flip open to it. So it is the very last chapter, and it is, so Proverbs chapter 31, I can, actually, if you give me a sec, I can even give you a page number, because I think these are all the same pew Bibles. Thank you. My pages are stuck there, so.
And the pages are way in the corner, which is kind of weird. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, no, they are, like, right there. It's kind of really got to spread out the book there to be able to see them. Yeah, 601. So starting there at the very bottom of the page, verse 10. Though it is worth saying, just as an aside here, chapters 30 and chapter 31 start with things that like flat out tell us that Solomon was not solely responsible for the contents here. Because chapter 30 is the sayings of Agur. So another person in chapter 31 starts with the teachings of King Lemuel's mother. Verse 10, a capable wife who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. And then it goes down through this, like, exhausting-to-read laundry list of all of the things that this amazing woman does to support not just her husband, but the whole household, making sure that, like, the kids are clothed and fed, that the servants are provided for. She's the one who goes out into the marketplace and is like buying and selling and trading and doing all of this stuff, which on the one hand, it's this fascinating for me case of like, you can look at this and go, this is like super like patriarchal, like, you know, here, the woman's worth is found in doing all of this stuff, not just in having like intrinsic value as a person. At the same time, it also points toward a reality where, you know, like clearly this woman has enough position and privilege to be out in the community doing all of this stuff. Because I can tell you, when I was in India 3 years ago, in India is an incredibly patriarchal society, which anybody living in India will tell you. You did not see, outside of like Delhi and like the big urban centers, you did not see very many women out in public. Like, it was men who ran the shops. It was men who, you know, were out doing business, and women were back at home because their job was like take care of the kids and cook. And so like the notion that, you know, like this woman is out there like being the one in the market, like buying the stuff, selling the stuff and trading, is actually probably more progressive than I think some people would immediately give it credit for. Even if the Lutheran in me wants to go, like, she is valued because she is a child of God, not just because she works hard. But it's very much, again, that idea of, like, see this, like, person who is, like, the picture perfect, like, you know, kind of, like, family provider here, loves her family, but puts her money where her mouth is, and goes and, like, makes sure that, like, those kids that she loves are not lacking for stuff, and that the servants in the house are not lacking for things, and that she uses the time and the gifts and abilities that she has to help make sure that all of the stuff is taken care of, so that there's food to go around and clothes to go around and a roof over their heads and all this other stuff, while her husband is off presumably doing his part of the deal, like farming or being a tradesman or what have you.
Or taking his seat among the elders.
Taking, right.
You know, so, but this is so classic. Huge expectations for a woman.
I mean, yes. And the ways in which this has been used to back that up. Because I grew up hearing, like, I heard more than one sermon as a kid about, you know, like the Mother's Day sermon that was the, like, tribute to mothers, but also is kind of the subtle, like, you know, here's what the expectations are for women on this, about aren't mothers wonderful because they do all this stuff, and shouldn't that be what we strive toward? And again, yeah, just reinforces a lot of those societal things of, like, oh, well, the perfect woman needs to, like, it's, did anybody see the Barbie movie? There's this bit in it where one of the women has kind of a meltdown of talking about the expectations of, like, modern women of, you need to go out there and be, like, you know, kick butt at the workplace and be, like, the boss lady who takes charge and, you know, shows everybody that, you know, just because you're a woman doesn't mean you can't go out there and be, like, the CEO or the best surgeon or the best this or the best that. But then you also need to go home and then be, like, the perfect, like, domestic goddess who makes the, you know, the, like, Pinterest-worthy, like, meals and does your kids' hair every morning before they go off to school right after you packed their lunch and, you know, do the dishes every night and don't leave a dirty sink and do the laundry and all this stuff. And she's like, and if you slip, you're not working hard enough. But then if you're, you know, so overscheduled that you don't have time for other stuff, oh, well, then you're just trying too hard. And it's like that double, that trap of, like, no matter what you do, somebody's going to be critical.
Yeah. And you expect yourself, because look at this, you expect yourself to be, do all those things, and then at my age level, you're expected to go out and have a job and bring home the money, but also run the household, like, all
yep.
that. And society expects you to get that. And it's two jobs. So here's your job you get a wage for, and then you have other 8 hours of work.
Right.
You know, yeah.
Which I've had to, within the last few weeks, I actually had the conversation with our daughters about kind of explaining, it's like, so our house works a little differently from the way in which a lot of people kind of look and expect, because the nature of, like, my career is that I have the flexibility of schedule and stuff to be the parent who, you know, does the errands, like, you know, cooks, like, does more of her stuff around the house, like, gets the girls to school and stuff. And that that's not what people expect. And then it creates this situation that I explained. It was because we were talking about how, like, you know, 100 years ago, women had only just gotten the right to vote and in this country, and that, you know, it was years yet before, like, you really saw women being able to, like, go into whatever career field they might want to and the like, or not. And, you know, the ability to choose, like, what do I feel called to? Do I feel called to, like, be a homemaker? Do I feel called to, like, have a full-time job? Do I try to find some kind of balance? And, like, when we talked about how, like, nowadays, yeah, it's a lot more, like, you know, when we talk about things like gender and sexism and stuff, it's like it doesn't look like, oh, you can't vote because you're a woman now. It looks more like if the girls do not look particularly put together and I'm the parent who is dropping them off at school, I get credit for the fact that I tried to put their hair up in ponytails and they might be a little sloppy looking. But isn't it so great that you've got a dad who is willing to, like, try to do your hair? Whereas if Colleen dropped them off in, like, a mismatched outfit with a ponytail that looked like it had been slept in the night before, suddenly she's a bad mom because she didn't take the time to, like, do their hair. Come on.
Those just role reversal, those standards of what is right still exist.
Oh, yeah.
And they should not.
Right.
I mean, you know.
And the like in Proverbs exists in this weird space where, like, it's simultaneously very reflective of a lot of those things because of the world that produced it, while at the same time having so much wisdom in it that also challenges, like, the notion that there's supposed to be this, like, radical, like, oh, this is only what women do, this is what men do, and never the twain shall meet kind of stuff that, like, some, like, you know, kind of, like, gender reductionists, like, you know, complementarianism, I think, is the fancy term for it, who look at the Bible and go, oh, well, clearly God wants women to basically just, you know, serve men. That's woman's purpose in existence kind of stuff. It was like, that's not really, I don't think, was what Paul was getting at when he said that in Christ there is no male nor female. And we see, like, lists of, like, strong women called by God to be leaders in Israel's history and in the early church and stuff. Like, I don't think that's a good reading of scripture to say that. But at the same time, you also can find the stuff there if you want to pull it out and try to use it to say that too.
Well, yeah, even if women have children, they may obey your husband.
Well, I mean, people are very good at, you know, cherry picking the things that back up with, you know, very what you want it to say. That's why I appreciate studying scripture together with other people, because I think it helps make it harder to do that, because you then get other perspectives that say, like, actually, that's not how I read this. What about, you know, this over here? What about that over there? And so on. Because, again, like, I think when we end up in, like, it's, you know, like, the whole echo chamber idea of, like, when you end up, when you're only hearing voices that sound like yours and only getting information that kind of conforms to what you already believe is true, it's really easy to just stay in that space and not realize that there are viewpoints other than that out there. Like, in social media has been terrible for this, because Facebook loves to just feed you, you know, the things that you'll click on, so they get ad revenue. And so they're like, oh, well, it seems like you believe this, so I'm going to fill up your, you know, news feed and your ads with things that, like, you're going to want to buy, you're going to want to click on, you're going to want to read, because we think this is what you believe. This is why I always click on weird ads when I get them, because I just like to confuse them, which is why Facebook tries to, like, sell me yurts and stuff. It's like, I'm not going to go buy a yurt, but I would rather Facebook think that that's what I want to do with my time, because, you know, if it's like, you want to waste my time, I'm going to waste yours.
I never ever thought to do it again, but that sounds really hilarious.
The funny thing with it is, like, the deeper down that rabbit hole you get, the weirder the stuff is. Like, mm-hmm. the moment where I was like, all right, maybe I need to slack off from this, was the day that I got ads for a book about, like, aliens using, like, ESP to, like, you know, heal us, and how you could tap into that. I was like, all right, this is so, like, I don't mind getting, like, ads for, like, Tibetan monk incense and, you know, like, the things like that. We have arrived at a new level of weird if we were to, like, ET can heal you if you, like, buy my book and, like, learn how to harness his power. Oh, sure.
I get strange email that I wonder, how in the world did these people get my email address?
Right. Oh, yeah. I'll whenever I pop into, like, the spam folder in my email, just to, like, make sure I didn't miss anything, I just, like, look through. It was like, who thought I wanted that?
Yeah. Okay.
So it's not just you.
Thank you.
So with that too, it's like, again, like, love is more than just marriage, right? And so, like, we actually get in Proverbs too, like, talking about other kinds of relationships, like, within families. Like, there's some stuff that connects in with, like, sibling relationships, which personally I never found all that relatable because I'm an only child, but did not prepare me well for having two kids, but grateful for Colleen's insights. There's the oldest of three sometimes, and understanding sibling dynamics, because this part of me is like, can't you just, like, shut up and leave each other alone if you don't get along? For, like, come on. Then I realized, like, the only person I'd ever leave alone if they were getting on my nerves is, like, the dog, which she was usually very happy to be left alone, but
especially
and the ways in which they can go from being each other's, like, best friends and, like, favorite playmates to trying to kill each other and back in, like, 3 minutes is, I'm like, how do you just swing between, like, these two, like, extremes so easily and then just, like, bounce back from it? Which, again, the magic of sibling relationships here, but which is supposed ultimately actually tying back in with this, gets to, like, the idea of, like, love in action being kind of the theme here. It's like the constructive of it looks like the idea of, like, a brother, again, like, some assumptions about the audience here, like, being, like, the one who is born to be a support in times of adversity. Like, that's what they're for, because that's 17. Chapter 17, verse 17. You know, like, a friend loves at all times, and kinsfolk are born to share adversity. Like, you know, part of family's job here is supporting one another through the hard times. You know, like, and I simultaneously appreciate that in that verse, there's the idea in it that blood is not inherently thicker than water, but family has a purpose, and it's to support one another in love. It's to get through the tough times together by banding together. And that can be something that also happens not just with your actual, like, you know, genetically related family, but something that, like, friends and community do together too. Which is somebody who, again, like, I'm an only child. Like, I don't have siblings to help me through the hard times. But I've got friends who are as close in some ways to me as, you know, like, Colleen is with her siblings and stuff. Who are the folks that I know, like, if things are rocky, I can send them a message and, you know, we'll talk about things.
You're an only child, you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I just about killed my mom when I was born, so they decided that they did not want to roll the dice on a second pregnancy, and or as I like to tell my kids, like, you know, since my parents, like, you know, hit like the grand slam, like the first at bat here, you know, they didn't need to, you know, try for another, like when you, you know, got the perfect child, like the first time. And meanwhile, like, Eileen and Nellie just, like, look at each other and look at me, and they're like, really? It's like, no. No, it was, Momo had a really strange reaction to, like, post-birth hormones that, like, almost, like, shut her liver down, and she nearly died. So she didn't have another kid. Yeah, it was.
My mom had 12 of us, the 12th one, she had a really hard time with her.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing how, like, it can just seem like it happens out of nowhere with that. Like, you'll, you know, like, even just with that, with, like, two pregnancies in our family, like, the first one was, like, textbook. You know, everything went exactly the way it's supposed to up until, like, our little gymnast from the get-go wrapped herself up in her umbilical cord so many times that she was not going to come out the old-fashioned way and, you know, wound up with a surprise C-section. But like pregnancy number two, like I'm sure Colleen would, you know, happily volunteer that like she spent the first half of it so feeling so awful from like morning sickness through like 20 weeks or so that she could barely function and could not eat hardly anything. Just to finally have that calm down. And then she wound up with gestational diabetes, like, for the second half of the pregnancy. So once her stomach let her eat things, she couldn't eat a bunch of things because they made her blood sugar spike. So.
Yeah. Her mom, she had 11 kids. She was ready for the 12th one.
Mm-hmm.
And she lay in the hospital for 3 days trying to have this baby. And the nurse and doctor said, well, don't you know how to have a baby? And then they found out the baby was breech.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
So she suffered all that time, and they said, don't you know how to have a baby?
I know.
And then they all died.
Right. It's, you know, like, we could have a whole separate conversation about, like, the ways in which, like, bias there comes into, like, the exam room and the delivery room and stuff with assumptions about, like, well, you should just know how to do this.
But you mean way back then, they didn't do
Oh, sure. Right. No, I mean, if it was, like, a absolute hair-on-fire, like, emergency kind of stuff, like, there's blood pouring out. Like, people would do it, but otherwise, yeah. Like, it was just a, like you said, like, what, don't you know how to have a baby? Mm-hmm. And if you didn't have, like, you know, a doctor or a midwife, right, yeah, like, number 12, it's like, yeah, like, I think I know what I'm doing here. And this is different.
I think the doctor's the one that didn't know what they're doing.
Probably. Well, and again, it's glad this one is going to be on a recording for posterity, but. Like the comment I heard once sometimes is like a man as an OB-GYN is a little like taking your car to a mechanic who doesn't own a car. It's like they just have a textbook understanding of things but don't have the lived experience of like, you know, your male doctor's never been pregnant, so they don't know what it feels like to, you know, have a baby and, you know, have that sense of like this is, you know, this feels like at least it's, you know, going right versus something's wrong here. Which I think, yeah, feeds into a lot of, well, don't you know how to have a baby by now? Come on. Kind of stuff. Or ignoring, like, you know, like, everybody makes the jokes about, you know, men getting, like, the man flu. Like, you know, like, a man acting like their cold is the end of the world. Whereas a woman is expected to be able to, you know, still carry the world while, you know, having a 103-degree fever. And it goes with like pain threshold expectations too. It's like, well, you're a woman. Like, you can handle that pain. Like, you give birth. And then write off stuff to like, if they paid a little better attention sooner, like, could have prevented like a major medical emergency. But so with family stuff, like, yeah, it's like, you know, children, siblings there. Again, it's the idea of like, you know, family love looks like supporting one another. Love between parents and children looks like support. Looks like, you know, like children trying to listen and learn and obey, like what their children say, what their parents say, rather. And for parents, looks like trying to be like the wise, caring, you know, guide who is, you know, helping like prepare their children for living well in the world and understanding what life is about and how to treat other people and how to know right from wrong and, you know, behave ethically. Which there's a laundry list of verses there around that. Like that theme of, you know, kind of the mutual expectation between parents and children of parents are expected to be like wise, caring, and supportive and show that love by, you know, teach your children well. And children are expected to, you know, learn from and accept that teaching and try to, you know, apply it and do their best to live up to, you know, the standards and expectations. While again, parents are expected to, you know, provide the boundaries and structure and discipline that's required to hold people accountable so that your kids learn and behave well. Which again, like, lends itself, like, I think it sometimes again gets into like baby and bathwater scenarios of some people take the, you know, idea of, you know, spare the rod and spoil the child kind of principles that are laid out there in a really unhealthy direction. You know, I think about my grandfather, like the Irish part of my family, whose parents like beat him every day because they said, well, we didn't see you do anything wrong today, but we're sure that you did. So this is your beating for that. You know, like that is not a healthy application of the idea of, you know, providing discipline and structure for your kids. But at the same time, like, the idea of there shouldn't be any at all and, you know, being afraid to, like, reprove your kids and have consequences for actions and, you know, discipline at the same time also doesn't achieve the goal either. It's like, what's the middle way here of providing that without also, like, teaching your children, you know, discipline but not actually teaching love in the process, right? So that's a lot.
I think we should have more, the schools should even teach parenting. I mean, this is good, and in church we can talk about it, but our society is not for the children anymore. Parents are, well, I was watching TV the other day, someplace they saw 16 kids, and Kevin, didn't we see that? Kevin was in the room from the time they were babies.
Oh yes, yeah.
Well, it's not.
There's this,
you know what, a lot of people grow up emulating what they see in their home, what their parents are doing, and they think that's the normal way that you need to live, and that's the normal way that you need to live and raise your children, and they don't have any role models, any good role models,
sure,
to teach them what they need to do and how they need to live.
Right.
Society has to change. I mean, this is terrible.
You know what?
Well, how can we, like, support and educate and provide those resources for folks to, like, be able to recognize, like, oh, maybe what I grew up with isn't actually, you know, for those people who grew up in really rough homes, like, this isn't actually the way that things should be. It's like, because Colleen and I, like, it was funny, but it's not. Like, when we had Eileen, like, it was easier to have a baby than to adopt a dog from the no-kill shelter.
That's true.
Because all you have to do to have a child is basically get pregnant and then buy a car seat. Like, you have to be able to prove that, like, yes, this baby is mine, and I have a car seat, and then they'll let you leave the hospital. Whereas, like, I could not leave the shelter with the dog without taking a personality test, you know, getting a background check done to make sure I didn't have, like, an animal cruelty, like, charge somewhere in my background, have an interview with somebody, go and, like, meet the dog and make sure that, you know, the dog seemed comfortable with me and stuff, made my roommate come with me to make sure that my roommate was clear, like, when I was in seminary. And then I could, like, fill out the adoption paperwork. And I was like, shoot. It's like, literally, it's like, all we had to do was, like, get pregnant and, like, buy a car seat at Target, like, in order to, like, bring a baby home.
And there's, you know what, there's no way, I think, for the school system to teach people parenting skills, because there's no one good answer to that question. There's so many different ways of raising a child and having a family, and there's no good answer to that question.
Sure, you know, I mean, and I think there are ways to probably provide resources and ideas and stuff, but I mean, you're right, there's not like a one size fits all kind of
thing. Especially with our country being the melting pot, and with people being from all over the world and all over different places in the world, and they have different backgrounds and they have different ways of raising their children or not raising their children, as the case may be. The rules are very different, and there's no way that they could really do that kind of thing in the school system with the way our country is run and is
headed. I taught an entire semester on just child development and parenting, and that course was highly popular with the kids, and even the textbook recognize, and over time they change too, of course, but recognize that yes, there are many influences in regard to parenting. But let's look at, you know, everything from, oh, there's a poem, forget the name of it or who wrote it, but if a child lives with ridicule, they will learn to condemn. I mean, you know, so there's sure. So many of that type of thing that, yeah, I firmly believe that school could teach it.
But with the way they've changed the curriculum in the school systems nowadays, they no longer teach things like shop and carpentry skills, these kinds of skills in the school system.
Which, because fortunately, we live in a district that is able to do
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
but though it's the exception, not the rule anymore.
A lot of the school systems no longer have those kinds of classes. Like when I went to school, I had sewing classes and cooking classes and things like that. And a lot of the schools no longer do that kind of stuff. So nowadays, the kids are not taught the basics of even being a citizen, being a human being.
It's a struggle. I mean, because like I'll say for my part, like, and admittedly, like, worth saying too, again, like, I went to private school 6th through 12th grade, so there were just limited funds and stuff for folks. But even in the public schools, like, they, by us, had mostly done away with, like, shop programs, had mostly done away with home ec, and the only way that, like, at least we had any kind of, like, consumer finance or, like, you know, personal finance education was because of the local credit union had some volunteers who would come in to, like, the schools and do, like, a couple of, like, sessions on that sort of stuff, like, as part of your economics class. But, yeah, I mean, like, I feel like it, yeah, like, there is this gate, like, the question that, like, I hear a lot of students ask, like, from when I was a student and now that I'm on the other side of it, is that, you know, is that, like, so when am I going to use any of this? How does this prepare me for life stuff? And like a lot, like there is a chunk of what, of having a name that like, yeah, because we've kind of gutted our school's ability to do a lot of that. Like there is some stuff that like is that very hands-on, like how do I balance, well, I guess you don't really balance a checkbook anymore in 2026, but how do I run my, you know, personal finances, right, responsibly. How do I understand how to do my taxes and understand like loan forms and things like that? How do I know how to like do these basic life things? How do I know how to like fix and repair stuff? It's like, we're not learning it at school. So the expectation is like, well, your parents will teach you. And then if they don't do that, it's like you're Yeah, we could also have a whole separate side conversation about the ways in which, yeah, like the athletics department at schools has learned how to soak up school funding like nobody's business and shut other stuff down. But in this community, that's also a dangerous conversation to have because there may be a little bit of a sports idolatry that goes on in this community and school. And it's not just here. And I mean, it's almost everywhere. Because, you know, I think about I saw a graphic, and I'll have to see if I can find it again, that was who is the highest paid, like, public employee in each state. So that included, like, public universities and stuff. No, it's the head football coach at the state university and over half the states in the country.
Okay.
Like, because, like, Like, and it's red state, blue state, purple state didn't matter. Like, an athletic coach at like the biggest public university was very often like the top like state employed wage earner because we love our college football, and
they report. They reward what's most valuable.
Yep, I say it's when you exactly. It's like one of my professors, like my history professor and advisor, always said, "Follow the money, and you will discover like what a group of people like really value and really think is important." And Exhibit A.
And a lot of schools are supported by the alumni, and the alumni pay the schools with their support.
Yep. And
their support is where the money goes.
Yep, exactly. You know, like I'll give you $1 million, but you're going to spend it on new seats in the stadium or new pads or paying the football coach or what have you.
Right.
And so we end up with, you know, the football coach is making, you know, millions of dollars in the actual education. That's the whole reason the university exists. Being handled, by professors who are
brainwashing the children
and barely paid for their work.
Right.
But all right, so if love in action, love looks like this very active response to stuff. What does it not look like? What's the opposite of it in Proverbs? So some of the same passages that we get the positive description give us the negative. Which is actually a really common formulation. Like, since I'm already open to it, like chapter 18, verse 24. Some friends play at friendship, but a true friend sticks closer than one's nearest kin. Like, you get the bad and the good paired there together. This is a really common thing that you'll see in Proverbs. You know, like the kind of bad cop, good cop formulation, which will flip order sometimes. Like, it's not consistently always the negative and then the positive. But yeah, it's like, well, if a loving, true friend, like, sticks close like their family, well, then a bad one is the one who doesn't. Like, they cut and run when things are difficult, or they're a corrupting influence that instead of encouraging you to do well in the hard times, like, leads you astray. Like in this, like, first, like, 9 chapters of Proverbs, like, where it's sort of the, like, you know, father giving advice to the child kind of stuff. One of the things that comes up again and again is, like, avoid the false friends who are going to be bad influences on you. Because, like, the ones who are going to say, let's just, you know, go and, like, you know, like, rob this person over there and, like, split the loot between us. Let's go and, you know, do the bad thing that's going to pay off right away because it's easy, like, and, like, quick money right now. stay away from the bad influences, because that's not what love looks like. It doesn't look like leading people astray and being corrupt. It doesn't look like abusive behavior. It doesn't look like, you know, like things that like undercut that sense of like connection and unity and community. Again, reflecting a little bit of the, you know, authorship and audience here, like there are multiple passages that talk about, you know, like quarrelsome or, you know, nagging spouses, like specifically, you know, usually referencing the wife here. But like that idea of like love doesn't look like tearing each other down or nitpicking or being unsupportive. It looks like building something together, not breaking something down. And then, of course, we circle back around here to adultery. Like, that's why it's the top, you know, like the one of the number one foolish, sinful actions you can do here, because it is the fullest manifestation of breaking stuff down instead of building stuff up. You know, it is, instead of building a family and a home and a life and a community, it's tearing them apart in ways that aren't just like tearing two people apart. It's tearing whole families. It's tearing whole communities apart. All right, well, that's what I've got. So I think we wound up kind of like, really like our discussion questions. Like, I think it's really just the question of like, so as we consider like what Proverbs says, like love and like looks like in families and stuff, you know, like, it's like, where have you seen that? Like, who have kind of like been your positive influences and what living out love looks like? Like, I'll say for myself, like, if imperfectly, my dad was always a really good example to me, like, little less once I hit my adult years and, like, you know, kind of like the divorce era of like family life and stuff. But growing up, like, my dad was a fantastic dad and generally a fairly supportive like spouse and husband and stuff, who, you know, very much believed in the idea of like family, like we're in this together, like we work together and we put our money where our mouth is, like when it comes to what we say our values are and who we care about. But especially I'll say like his mom, like my meemaw, who comes up occasionally in sermon examples and stuff, was absolutely this force of very stubborn Scottish American nature, who, you know, like just fiercely loved her family and, you know, would go to the mats for any member of the family, but also was like the kind of person who, her phrase that she would use, like, well, I'm just good at adopting strays. And so, like, those people who did not have, you know, the good family to go home to for Thanksgiving, she would invite them over. You know, like, well, come hang out with us and fix your plate. And things like that. Like, we had got a person who was like, you would not guess she is not related to the rest of us. Like, kind of, like, who was a daughter of one of my meemaw's best friends, whose home life, I think, was a little messier than anybody ever wanted to say out loud. And so she just comes and hangs out with us for, you know, the holidays and stuff. And, like, I actually was, I was pushing middle school before I realized she was not actually, like, just one of my, you know, dad's cousins or something, but actually was just, like, a, you know, daughter of a friend. If we brought things in for a landing, then thanks for being here and being part of stuff. Next week, we will take a look at kind of the flip side of this. We looked at like the interpersonal bit of like love is, you know, like a family thing and a marriage thing and a friendship thing. So we'll kind of look at the, like, okay, so what does this idea look like when we start talking about wider society? What does it look like to be a person out in the world, like, in relationship with, like, other people and community and stuff like that? Like, so that's what we'll look at next time, and there's a lot of good stuff there.